After a while, he had said to her, "Look, whenever you do this, it is going to be as bad for you as now. You don't want to be unfaithful, and you don't want anyone to know, but it will be like that whenever it happens. I want to do it, but I don't want to hurt him. I have to do it. It's not in my hands anymore." "Then do it now." "But it's terribly dangerous now." "Do you think there is anyone on this ship that sees us and hears us and knows us that thinks we have not slept together? Do you think the things we have done are any different from that?"
"Oh, of course they are different. There is all the difference. We couldn't have a baby from what we have done."
"You're wonderful," he said. "You really are.
But if we have a baby, I'll be glad. He wants a baby very much, and we never have one. I'll sleep with him right away, and he'll never know it is ours."
"I wouldn't sleep with him right away."
"No, I suppose not, but the next night."
"How long since you slept with him?"
"Oh, I sleep with him every night. I have to, Hudson. I get so excited, I have to. I think that's one reason he plays bridge until so late now. He'd like me to be asleep when he comes in. I think he is getting a little tired since we have been in love."
"Is this the first time you have ever been in love since you married him?"
"No. I am sorry. But it is not. I have been in love several times, but I have never been unfaithful to him or even considered it. He is so good and nice and such a good husband, and I like him so much, and he loves me and is always kind to me."
"I think we'd better go down to the Ritz and have some champagne," Thomas Hudson had said. His feelings were becoming very mixed. The Ritz was deserted, and a waiter brought them the wine at one of the tables against the wall. They kept the Perrier Jouet Bru 1915 on ice all of the time now and simply asked,
"The same wine, Mr. Hudson?"
They raised their glasses to each other, and the princess said,
"I love this wine, don't you?"
"Very much."
"What are you thinking about?"
"You."
"Naturally, all I think about is you. But what about me?"
"I was thinking we should go down to my cabin now. We talk too much and fool around too much and do nothing." "What time have you?"
10 after 11.
"What time have you?" he called to the wine steward. 11:15, sir."
The steward looked at the clock inside the bar. When the steward was out of earshot, he asked, "How late will he play bridge?"
"He said he would play late and for me not to stay awake for him."
"We'll finish the wine and go to the cabin. I have some there."
"But Hudson, it's very dangerous."
"It will always be dangerous," Thomas Hudson had said. "But not doing it is getting to be a damn sight more dangerous." That night he made love to her 3 times, and when he took her to her cabin, she had said that he shouldn't, and he had said that it would look much sounder if he did, the prince was still playing bridge. Thomas Hudson had gone back to the Ritz, where the bar was still open, and ordered another bottle of the same wine, and read the papers that had come aboard at Haifa. He realized that it was the first time he had had time to read the papers in a long time, and he felt very relaxed and very happy to be reading the papers. When the bridge game broke up and the prince came by and looked into the Ritz, Thomas Hudson asked him to have a glass of wine before he went to bed, and he liked the prince more than ever and felt a strong kinship with him. He and the Baron had got off the ship at Marseille. Most of the others were going on for the rest of the cruise, which finished at Southampton. In Marseille, he and the Baron were sitting at a sidewalk restaurant in the Vieux Port, eating moules marinières and drinking a carafe of vin rosé. Thomas Hudson was very hungry, and he remembered that he had been hungry most of the time ever since they had left Haifa. He was damned hungry now, too, he thought. Where the hell were those servants? At least one should have shown up. It was blowing colder than ever outside. It reminded him of the cold day there on the steep street in Marseille that ran down to the port, sitting at the cafe table with their coat collars up, eating the moule out of the thin black shells you lifted from the hot peppery milk broth with hot melted butter floating in it, drinking the wine from Tavel that tasted the way Provence looked, and watching the wind blow the skirts of the fisherwomen, the cruise passengers and the ill-dressed whores of the port as they climbed the steep cobbled street with the Mistral lashing at them.
"You have been a very naughty boy," the Baron had said. "Very naughty indeed. Do you want some more moule?" "No, I want something solid."
"Shouldn't we have a bouillabaisse, too?"
"Two soups? I'm hungry, and we won't be here again for a long time." "I should think you might be hungry. Good. We'll have a bouillabaisse, and then a good Chateaubriand, very rare. I'll build you up, you bastard."
"What are you going to do?"
"The question is, what are you going to do? Do you love her?"
"No."
"That's much better. It's better for you to leave now, much better."
"I promised to spend some time with them for the fishing."
"If it were the shooting, it might be worthwhile," the Baron had said. "The fishing is very cold and very unpleasant, and she has no business to make a fool of her husband."
"He must know about it."
"He does not. He knows she is in love with you. That is all. You are a gentleman, so whatever you do is all right, but she has no business to make a fool of her husband. You wouldn't marry her, would you?"
"No."
"She couldn't marry you anyway, and there's no need that he should be made unhappy unless you are in love with her."
"I'm not. I know that now."
"Then I think you should get out."
"I'm quite sure that I should."
"I'm so glad you agree. Now tell me, truly, how is she?"
"She's very well."
"Don't be silly. I knew her mother. You should have known her mother."
"I'm sorry I didn't."
"You should be. I don't know how you got yourself mixed up with such good, dull people. You don't need her for your painting or anything like that, do you?"
"No, that's not the way it's done. I like her very much. I still like her. But I'm not in love with her, and it's getting very complicated."
"I'm so glad that you agree. Now, where do you think that you will go?"
"We've just come from Africa."
"Exactly. Why don't you go to Cuba for a while or the Bahamas? I could join you if I get a hold of any money at home."
"Do you think you will get any money at home?"
"No."
"I think I will stay in Paris for a while. I've been away from town for a long time."
"Paris isn't town. London is town."
"I'd like to see what's going on in Paris."
"I can tell you what's going on."
"No, I mean, I want to see the pictures and some people and go to the Six Day and Auteuil and Enghien and Le Tremblay. Why don't you stay?"
"I don't like racing and I can't afford to gamble."
And why go on with that, he thought now. The Baron was dead and the Krauts had Paris and the princess did not have a baby. There would be no blood of his in any royal house, he thought, unless he had a nosebleed sometime in Buckingham Palace, which seemed extremely unlikely. If one of those boys did not come in 20 minutes, he decided, he would go down into the village and get some eggs and some bread. It is a hell of a thing to be hungry in your own house, he thought. But I'm too damn tired to go down there. Just then he heard someone in the kitchen, and he pushed the buzzer that was set in the underside of the big table and heard it burr twice in the kitchen. The second houseboy came in with his faintly fairy, half-Saint Sebastian, sly, crafty, and long-suffering look, and said,
"You rang?"
"What the hell do you think I did? Where is Mario?"
"He went for the mail."
"How are all the cats?"
"Very well, without news. Big goats fought with El Gordo, but we treated the wounds."
"Boise looks thin."
"He goes out much at night."
"How is Princessa?"
"She was a little sad, but she eats well now."
"Did you have difficulty getting meat?"
"We got it from Cotoro."
"How are the dogs?"
"All of them are well. Negrita is with puppies again."
"Couldn't you keep her shut up?"
"We tried, but she escaped."
"Has anything else happened?"
"Nothing. How was the voyage?"
"Without incident." As he talked, irritated and short as always with this boy, who he had let go twice but had taken back each time when his father had come and pled for him, Mario, the first houseboy, came in carrying the papers in the mail. He was smiling and his brown face was gay and kind and loving.
"How was the voyage?"
"A little rough at the end."
"Figurati, imagine it. It's a big norther. Have you eaten?"
"There's nothing to eat."
"I brought eggs and milk and bread, too," he said to the second houseboy. "Go in and prepare the caballero's breakfast. How do you want the eggs?"
"As usual."
"Los huevos como siempre," Mario said. "Was Boise there to meet you?"
"Yes."
"He has suffered very much this time, more than ever."
"And the others?"
"Only one bad fight between goats and fats."
He used the English names proudly.
The princess was a little sad, but it was nothing.
You too?
Me?
He smiled shyly and very pleased.
Very well, thank you very much.
And the family?
All very well, thank you. Papa is working again.
I am glad.
He is too. Did none of the other gentlemen sleep here?
No, they all went into town.
They must be tired.
They are.
There were calls from various friends. I have them all written down. I hope you can recognize them. I can do nothing with the English names.
Write them as they sound.
But they do not sound the same to me as to you.
Did the colonel call?
No, sir.
Bring me a whiskey with mineral water, Thomas Hudson said, and bring milk for the cats, please.
In the dining room or here?
The whiskey here, the milk for the cats in the dining room.
Instantly, Mario said.
He went into the kitchen and came back with a whiskey and mineral water.
I think it is strong enough, he said.
Should I shave now or wait till after breakfast, Thomas Hudson thought. I ought to shave. That's what I ordered the whiskey for, to get me through the shaving. All right, go in and shave then. The hell with it, he thought. No, go in and do it. It's good for your damn morale, and you have to go into town after breakfast. Shaving, he sipped the drink halfway through lathering, after lathering, and during the process of re-lathering, and changing blades 3 times and getting the 2-week stubble off his cheeks, chin, and throat. The cat walked around and watched him while he shaved and rubbed against his legs. Then suddenly he bounded out of the room, and Thomas Hudson knew he had heard the milk bowls being put down on the tiled floor of the dining room. He had not heard the click himself, nor had he heard any calling, but Boise had heard it. Thomas Hudson finished shaving and poured his right hand full of the wonderful 90-degree pure alcohol that was as cheap in Cuba as miserable rubbing alcohol in the States, and doused it over his face, feeling its cold bite take away the soreness from the shaving. I don't use sugar, nor smoke tobacco, he thought, but by God, I get my pleasure out of what they distill in this country. The lower parts of the bathroom windows were painted over because the stone-paved patio ran all around the house, but the upper halves of the windows were of clear glass, and he could see the branches of the palm trees whipping in the wind. She's blowing even heavier than I thought. There would almost be time to haul out, but you can't tell. It all depends on what she does when she goes into the northeast. It certainly had been fun not to think about the sea for the last few hours. Let's keep it up, he thought. Let's not think about the sea, nor what is on it, or under it, or anything connected with it. Let's not even make a list of what we will not think of about it. Let's not think of it at all. Let's just have the sea in being and leave it at that. And the other things, he thought, we won't think about them either.
This ends Disc 6.
Where would the Signor like to have breakfast? Mario asked.
Any place away from the puta sea.
In the living room or in the Signor's bedroom?
In the bedroom. Pull out the wicker chair and put the breakfast on a table by it. He drank the hot tea and ate a fried egg and some toast with orange marmalade. Is there no fruit?
Only bananas.
Bring some.
Are they not bad with alcohol?
That is superstition.
But while you're away, a man died in the village from eating bananas when he was drinking rum.
How do you know he wasn't just a banana-eating rummy who died from rum?
No, senor. This man died very suddenly from drinking a small amount of rum after eating a large quantity of bananas. They were his own bananas from his garden. He lived on the hill behind the village and worked for the route number 7 of the buses.
May he rest in peace, Thomas Hudson said. Bring me a few bananas. Mario brought the bananas, small, yellow, ripe, from the tree in the garden. They were hardly bigger, peeled, than a man's fingers, and they were delicious. Thomas Hudson ate 5 of them. Observe me for symptoms, he said, and bring the princessa to eat the other egg.
I gave her an egg to celebrate your return, the boy said. I also gave an egg to Boise and to Willie.
What about goats?
The gardener said it was not good for goats to eat much until his wounds are healed. His wounds were severe.
What sort of fight was it?
It was very serious. They fought for nearly a mile.
We lost them in the thorn brush beyond the garden. They fought with no noise at all, the way they fight now. I don't know who won. Big Goats came in first, and we took care of his wounds. He came to the patio and lay beside the cistern. He couldn't jump to the top of it. Fats came in an hour later, and we cared for his wounds.
Do you remember how loving they were when they were brothers?
Of course, but I'm afraid now that Fats will kill Goats. He must weigh nearly a pound more.
Goats is a great fighting cat.
Yes, senor, but figure out for yourself what a full pound means.
I don't think it can mean as much in cats as it does in fighting cocks. You think of everything in terms of fighting chickens. It doesn't mean much in men unless one man must weaken himself to make the weight. Jack Dempsey weighed only 185 pounds when he won the championship of the world. Willard weighed 230. Goats and Fats are both big cats.
The way they fight, a pound is a terrible advantage, Mario said. If they were being fought for money, no one will give away a pound. They will not give away ounces.
Bring me some more bananas.
Please, senor.
You really believe that nonsense?
It's not nonsense, senor.
Then bring me another whiskey and mineral water.
If you order me to.
I ask you to.
If you ask, it is an order.
Then bring it. The boy brought in the whiskey with ice and cold, charged mineral water, and Thomas Hudson took it and said, "Observe me for symptoms." But the worried look on the boy's dark face made him tire of the teasing, and he said, "Truly, I know it will not make me sick."
"The senor knows what he is doing, but it was my duty to protest."
"That's all right. You've protested. Has Pedro come yet?"
"No, senor."
"When he comes, tell him to have the Cadillac ready to go to town at once." "Now you take a bath," Thomas Hudson said to himself, "then you dress for Havana, then you ride into town to see the colonel." "What the hell is wrong with you?" "Plenty is wrong with me," he thought. "Plenty. The land of plenty, the sea of plenty, the air of plenty." He sat in the wicker chair with his feet pulled up on the extension that pulled out from under the seat and looked at the pictures on the wall of his bedroom. At the head of the bed, the cheap bed, with the no-good mattress that had been bought as an economy because he never slept in it except in case of quarrels, there was Juan Gris's guitar player. "Nostalgia echa hombre," he thought in Spanish. People did not know that you died of it. Across the room, above the bookcase, was Paul Klee's Monument in Arbeit. He didn't love it as he loved the guitar player, but he loved to look at it, and he remembered how corrupt it had seemed when he first bought it in Berlin. The color was as indecent as the plates in his father's medical books that showed the different types of cankers and venereal ulcers, and how frightened of it his wife had been until she learned to accept its corruption and only see it as a painting. He knew no more about it now than when he first saw it in Flechtheim's gallery in the house by the river that wonderful cold fall in Berlin when they had been so happy. But it was a good picture, and he liked to look at it. Above the other bookcase was one of Masson's forests. This was Ville d'Avray, and he loved it the way he loved the guitar player. That was the great thing about pictures. You could love them with no hopelessness at all. You could love them without sorrow, and the good ones made you happy because they had done what you always tried to do. So it was done, and it was all right, even if you failed to do it. Boise came into the room and jumped up onto his lap. He jumped beautifully and could leap, without effort showing, to the top of the high chest of drawers in the big bedroom. Now, having leaped moderately and neatly, he settled down on Thomas Hudson's lap and made loving pushes with his forepaws. "I'm looking at the pictures, boy. You'd be better off if you liked pictures." "Who knows, though, but he may get as much from leaping and from night hunting as I get from the pictures," Thomas Hudson thought. "It's a damn shame he can't see them, though. You can't tell. He might have frightful taste in pictures." "I wonder who you'd like, boy. Probably the Dutch period when they painted such wonderful still lifes of fish and oysters and game. Hey, lay off me there. This is the daytime. You're not supposed to do that sort of thing in the daytime." Boise continued with his lovemaking, and Thomas Hudson pushed him onto his side to quiet him. You have to observe a few decencies, boy, he said. I haven't even gone out to see the other cats to please you. Boise was happy, and Thomas Hudson felt the purr in his throat with his fingers. I have to bathe, boy. You spend half your time doing that, but you do it with your own tongue. That's when you won't pay attention to me. When you wash yourself, you're just like a damned businessman at his office. That's business. That's not to be interrupted. Well, I have to bathe now. But instead, I sit here drinking in the morning like a damned rummy. That's one of the differences between us. You couldn't steer 18 hours either. I can, though. 12 any time. 18 when I have to. 19 yesterday and this morning. But I can't jump and I can't hunt at night like you. We do some pretty damn fancy hunting at night, though. But you've got your radar and your whiskers, and a pigeon probably has his huff-duff and that incrustation above his beak. Anyway, all homing pigeons have the incrustation. What sort of ultra-high frequencies have you got, boy? Boise lay there heavy and solid and long, purring silently and very happy. What does your search receiver say, boy? What's your pulse width? What's your pulse repetition frequency? I've got a magnetron built in, but don't tell anybody. But with the consequent higher resolution attained by the UHF, enemy horrors can be detected at a greater distance. It's microwave, boy, and you're purring it right now. So that's how you kept your resolution not to think about it until we get going again. It wasn't the sea you wanted to forget. You know how you love the sea and would not be anywhere else. Go out onto the porch and look at her. She is not cruel or callous, nor any of that kvatch. She is just there, and the wind moves her, and the current moves her, and they fight on her surface, but down below, none of it matters. Be thankful that you are going out on her again, and thank her for being your home. She is your home. Don't talk or think nonsense about her. She is not your trouble. You're making a little more sense, he told himself. Although you don't make too damned much ashore. All right, he told himself, I have to make so much sense at sea that I don't want to make any ashore. Ashore is a lovely place, he thought. Today we would see just how lovely it could be. After I see the goddamn colonel, he thought. Well, I always enjoy seeing him because it builds up my morale. Let's not go into the colonel, he thought. That's one of those things that we are going to skip while we have a lovely day. I will go to see him, but I won't go into him. Enough has gone into him already that will never get out, and enough has gone out of him that they will never get back in. So I thought you weren't going into him. I'm not. I'm just going in to see him and report. He finished the drink, lifted the cat off his lap, stood up and looked at the three paintings, and then went in and took a shower. The water heater had only been on since the boys came in the morning, and there was not much hot water. But he soaped himself clean, scrubbed his head, and finished off with cold water. He dressed in white flannel shirt, dark tie, flannel slacks, wool socks, and his 10-year-old English brogues, a cashmere pullover sweater, and an old tweed jacket. He rang for Mario. Is Pedro here?
Yes, senor, he has a car outside.
Make me a Tom Collins with coconut water and bitters to take. Put it in one of the cork holders.
Yes, senor. Don't you want a coat?
I'll take a coat to wear back if it gets cold.
Will you be back for lunch?
No, nor for dinner.
Do you want to see any of the cats before you go? They are all out in the lee of the wind and the sun.
No, I will see them tonight. I want to bring them a present.
I go to make the drink. It will take a moment for the coconut.
Now, why in hell wouldn't you go to see the cats? He asked himself. I don't know, he answered. That one I did not understand at all. That was a new one. Boise was following him, a little worried at this going away, but not panicky, since there was no baggage and no packing. Maybe I did it for you, boy, Thomas Hudson said. Don't you worry, I'll be back sometime tonight or in the morning, with my ashes dragged, I hope. Properly, I hope. Then maybe we will make a little better sense around here. Vamonos a limpiar la escopeta. He came out of the long, bright living room that still seemed enormous and down the stone steps and into the even greater brightness of the Cuban winter morning. The dogs played around his legs and the sad pointer came up, groveling and wagging his lowered head. "You poor, miserable beast," he said to the pointer. He patted him, and the dog fawned on him. The other mongrel dogs were gay and prancing in the excitement of the cold and the wind. There were some dead branches broken off the ceiba tree that grew out of the patio, and they lay on the steps where they had fallen in the wind. The chauffeur came from behind the car, shivering exaggeratedly, and said,
"Good morning, Mr. Hudson. How was the voyage?"
"Good enough. How are the cars?"
"All in perfect shape."
"I'll bet," Thomas Hudson said in English. Then to Mario, who came out of the house and down the steps to the car carrying the tall, dark, rusty-colored drink, wrapped round with a sheet of molded cork that came to within half an inch of the rim of the glass. "Get a sweater for Pedro, one of those that buttons in the front, from Mr. Tom's clothes. See that the steps are clean to this trash." Thomas Hudson handed the drink to the chauffeur to hold and stooped to pet the dogs. Boise was sitting on the steps, watching them with contempt. There was Negrita, a small black bitch going gray with age, her tail curled over her back, her tiny feet and delicate legs almost sparkling as she played, her muzzle as sharp as a fox terrier, and her eyes loving and intelligent. He had seen her one night in a bar following some people out and asked what breed of dog she was.
"Cuban," the waiter said. "She's been here 4 days. She follows everyone out, but they always shut the doors of the cars on her."
They had taken her home to the finca, and for 2 years she had not been in heat, and Thomas Hudson had thought she was too old to breed. Then, one day, he had to break her loose from a police dog, and after that she had police dog pups, pups from a pit bull, pointer pups, and a wonderful unknown pup that was bright red and looked as though his father might have been an Irish setter, except that he had the chest and shoulders of a pit bull and a tail that curled up over his back like Negrita's. Now her sons were all around her, and she was pregnant again.
"Who did she breed with?" Thomas Hudson asked the chauffeur.
"I don't know."
Mario, who came out with a sweater and gave it to the chauffeur, who took off his frayed uniform coat to put it on, said,
"The father is the fighting dog in the village."
"Well, goodbye, dogs," Thomas Hudson said. "So long, boy," he said to the cat who came bounding down through the dogs to the car. Thomas Hudson, sitting in the car now, holding the cork-wrapped drink, leaned out of the window and touched the cat, who rose on his hind legs to push his head against his fingers. "Don't worry, boy, I'll be back."
"Poor Boise," Mario said.
He picked him up and held him in his arms, and the cat looked after the car as it turned, circling the flower bed, and went down the uneven gully-washed driveway until it was hidden by the hill slope and the tall mango trees. Then Mario took the cat into the house and put him down, and the cat jumped up onto the windowsill and continued to look out at where the driveway disappeared under the hill. Mario stroked him. The cat did not relax.
"Poor Boise," the tall Negro boy said. "Poor, poor Boise."
In the car, Thomas Hudson and the chauffeur went down the driveway, and the chauffeur jumped out and unchained the gate, and then climbed back in and drove the car through. A Negro boy was coming up the street, and he called to him to close the gate, and the boy grinned and nodded his head.
"He's the younger brother of Mario."
"I know," Thomas Hudson said. They rolled through the squalor of the village side street and turned onto the central highway. They passed the houses of the village, the two grocery stores open onto the street with their bars and rows of bottles flanked by shelves of canned goods, and then were past the last bar and the huge Spanish laurel tree whose branches spread all the way across the road and were rolling downhill on the old stone highway. The highway ran downhill for 3 miles with big old trees on either side. There were nurseries, small farms, large farms with their decrepit Spanish colonial houses that were being cut up into subdivisions, their old hilly pastures being cut by streets that ended at grassy hillsides, the grass brown from the drought. The only green now on the land, in this country of so many greens, was along the watercourses where the royal palms grew tall and gray, their green tops slanted by the wind. This was a dry norther, dry, hard, and cold. The Straits of Florida had been chilled by the other northers that had come before it, and there was no fog and no rain with this wind. Thomas Hudson took a sip of the ice-cold drink that tasted of the fresh green lime juice mixed with the tasteless coconut water that was still so much more full-bodied than any charged water, strong with the real Gordon's gin that made it alive to his tongue and rewarding to swallow, and all of it tautened by the bitters that gave it color. It tastes as good as a drawing sail feels, he thought. It is a hell of a good drink. The cork glass holder kept the ice from melting and weakening the drink, and he held it fondly in his hand and looked at the country as they drove into town. Why don't you coast down here and save gas?
I will if you say, the chauffeur answered, but this is government gas.
Coast for the practice, Thomas Hudson said. Then you will know how to do it when it is our gas and not the government's. They were down on the flat now, where flower growers' fields ran off the left, and on the right were the houses of the basket weavers. I must get a basket weaver to come up and mend the big mat in the living room where it's worn.
Si, signor.
Do you know one?
Si, signor.
The chauffeur, whom Thomas Hudson disliked very much for his general misinformation and stupidity, his conceit, his lack of understanding of motors, and his atrocious care of the cars and general laziness, was being very short and formal because of the reprimand about coasting. With all his faults, he was a splendid driver, that is, he was an excellent car handler with beautiful reflexes in the illogical and neurotic Cuban traffic. Also, he knew too much about their operations to be fired. Are you warm enough with the sweater?
Si, señor.
The hell with you, Thomas Hudson thought. You keep that up and I'll ream you out good. Was it very cold in your house last night?
It was terrible. It was horroroso. You can't imagine it, Mr. Hudson.
Peace had been made, and they were now crossing the bridge, where the trunk of the girl who had once been cut into six pieces by her policeman lover and the pieces wrapped in brown paper and scattered along the central highway had been found. The river was dry now. But on that evening it had been running with water and cars had been lined up for half a mile in the rain while their drivers stared at the historic spot. The next morning the papers published photographs of the torso on their front pages, and one news story pointed out that the girl was undoubtedly a North American tourist, since no one of that age living in the tropics could be so undeveloped physically. How they had already arrived at her exact age, Thomas Hudson never knew, since the head was not discovered until sometime later in the fishing port of Batabano. But the torso, as shown in the front pages, did fall rather short of the best fragments of Greek sculpture. She was not an American tourist, though, and it turned out that she had developed whatever attractions she had in the tropics. But for a while, Thomas Hudson had to give up doing any road work in the country outside the finca, because anybody seen running or even hurrying was in danger of being pursued by the populace, crying, "There he goes! That's him! That's the man who chopped her up!" Now they were over the bridge and going up the hill into Liano, where there was a view off to the left of El Cerro that always reminded Thomas Hudson of Toledo. Not El Greco's Toledo, but a part of Toledo itself seen from a side hill. They were coming up on it now as the car climbed the last of the hill, and he saw it again clearly, and it was Toledo, all right, just for a moment. And then the hill dipped, and Cuba was close on either side. This was the part he did not like on the road into town. This was really the part he carried the drink for. A drink against poverty, dirt, 400-year-old dust, the nose snot of children, cracked palm fronds, roofs made from hammered tins, the shuffle of untreated syphilis, sewage in the old beds of brooks, lice on the bare necks of infested poultry, scale on the backs of old men's necks, the smell of old women, and the full-blast radio, he thought. It is a hell of a thing to do. I ought to look at it closely and do something about it. Instead, you have your drink the way they carried smelling salts in the old days. No, not quite that, he thought. Sort of a combination of that and the way they drank in Hogarth's Gin Lane. You're drinking against going in to see the colonel, too, he thought. You're always drinking against something or for something now, he thought. The hell you are. Lots of times you are just drinking. You're going to do quite a lot of it today. He took a long sip of the drink and felt it clean and cold and fresh tasting in his mouth. This was the worst part of the road, where the streetcar line ran and the traffic was bumper to bumper on the level crossing of the railroad when the gates were down. Ahead now, beyond the lines of stalled cars and trucks, was the hill with the castle of Atares, where they had shot Colonel Crittenden and the others when that expedition failed down at Bahia Honda 40 years before he was born, and where they had shot 122 American volunteers against that hill. Beyond, the smoke blew straight across the sky from the tall chimneys of the Havana Electric Company, and the highway ran on the old cobblestones under the viaduct, parallel to the upper end of the harbor, where the water was as black and greasy as the pumpings from the bottoms of the tanks of an oil tanker. The gates came up, and they moved again, and now they were in the lee of the norther, and the wooden-hulled ships of the pitiful and grotesque wartime merchant marine lay against the creosoted pilings of the wooden docks, and the scum of the harbor lay along their sides, blacker than the creosote of the pilings, and foul as an uncleaned sewer. He recognized various craft that he knew. One, an old bark, had been big enough for a sub to bother with, and the sub had shelled her. She was loaded with timber and was coming in for a cargo of sugar. Thomas Hudson could still see where she had been hit, although she was repaired now, and he remembered the live Chinaman and the dead Chinaman on her deck when they had come alongside her at sea. I thought you weren't going to think about the sea today. I have to look at it, he said to himself. Those that are on it are a damn sight better off than those that live in what we have just been riding through. This harbor that has been fouled for 300 or 400 years isn't the sea anyway. And this harbor isn't bad out by the mouth, nor even so bad over by the Casablanca side. You've known good nights in this harbor, and you know it. Look at that, he said. The chauffeur, seeing him looking, started to stop the car, but he told him to go on. Keep going to the embassy, he said. He had looked at the old couple that lived in the board and palm frond lean-to they had built against the wall that separated the railway track from a tract of ground where the electric company stored coal they unloaded from the harbor. The wall was black with coal dust from the coal that was hauled overhead on the unloader, and it was less than 4 feet from the roadbed of the railway. The lean-to was built at a steep slant, and there was barely room for two people to lie down in it. The couple who lived in it were sitting in the entrance cooking coffee in a tin can. They were Negroes, filthy, scaly with age and dirt, wearing clothing made from old sugar sacks, and they were very old. He could not see the dog. ¿Y el perro? He asked the chauffeur. Since a long time I haven't seen him. They had passed these people now for several years. At one time, the girl, whose letters he had read last night, had exclaimed about the shame of it each time they passed the lean-to. Why don't you do something about it, then? He had asked her. Why do you always say things are so terrible and write so well about how terrible they are and never do anything about it? This made the girl angry, and she had stopped the car, gotten out, gone over to the lean-to, and given the old woman $20 and told her this was to help her find a better place to live and to buy something to eat.
Sí, señorita, the old woman said, you are very amiable.
The next time they came by, the couple were living in the same place, and they waved happily. They had bought a dog. It was a white dog, too, small and curly, probably not bred originally, Thomas Hudson thought, for the coal dust trade. What do you think has become of the dog? Thomas Hudson asked the chauffeur.
He probably died. They have nothing to eat.
We must get them another dog, Thomas Hudson said. Past the lean-to, which was now well behind them, they passed on the left the mud-colored plastered walls of the headquarters of the general staff of the Cuban army. A Cuban soldier with some white blood stood indolently but proudly in his khakis faded from his wife's washings, his campaign hat much neater than General Stilwell's, his Springfield at the most comfortable angle across the ill-covered bones of his shoulder. He looked at the car, absently. Thomas Hudson could see he was cold in the norther. I suppose he could warm up by walking his post, Thomas Hudson thought, But if he stays in that exact position and does not waste any energy, the sun should be on him soon, and that will warm him. He must not have been in the army very long to be so thin, he thought. By spring, if we still come by here in the spring, I probably will not recognize him. That Springfield must be awfully heavy for him. It is a shame he cannot stand guard with a light plastic gun the way bullfighters now use a wooden sword in their work with the muleta, so their wrists will not tire. What about the division that General Benitez was going to lead into battle in Europe, he asked the chauffeur. Has that division left yet?
Todavía no, the chauffeur said. Not yet, but the general is practicing learning to ride a motorcycle. He practices early in the morning along the Malecón.
It must be a motorized division then, Thomas Hudson said. What are those packages that the soldiers and officers are carrying as they come out of the Estado Mayor?
Rice, the chauffeur said. There was a cargo of rice came in.
Is it difficult to get now?
Impossible, it's in the clouds.
Do you eat badly now?
Very badly.
Why, you eat at the house. I pay for everything, no matter how far the price goes up.
I mean when I eat at home.
When do you eat at home?
Sundays.
I'll have to buy you a dog, Thomas Hudson said.
We have a dog, the chauffeur said. A really beautiful and intelligent dog. He loves me more than anything in the world. I cannot move a foot that he does not want to come with me. But, Mr. Hudson, you cannot realize nor appreciate, you who have everything, what this war means in suffering to the people of Cuba.
There must be much hunger.
You cannot realize it.
No, I can't, Thomas Hudson thought. I can't realize it at all. I can't realize why there should ever be any hunger in this country, ever. And you, you son of a bitch, for the way you look after the motors of cars, you ought to be shot, not fed. I would shoot you with the greatest of pleasure, but he said, I will see what I can do about getting you some rice for your house.
Thank you very much. You cannot conceive of how hard life is now for us Cubans.
It must be really bad, Thomas Hudson said. It is a shame I cannot take you to sea for a rest and a vacation.
It must be very difficult at sea, too.
I believe it is, Thomas Hudson said. Sometimes, even on a day such as today, I believe it is.
We all have our crosses to bear.
I would like to take my cross and stick it up the culo of a lot of people I know.
It is necessary to take things with calm and patience, Mr. Hudson.
Muchas gracias, said Thomas Hudson. They had turned into San Isidro Street, below the main railway station, and opposite the entrance to the old P&O docks, where the ships from Miami and Key West used to dock, and where Pan American Airways had its terminal when they were still flying the old clippers. It was abandoned now that the P&O boats had been taken over by the Navy, and Pan American was flying DC-2s and DC-3s to the Rancho Boyeros Airport, and the Coast Guard and the Cuban Navy had their subchasers tied up where the clippers used to land. Thomas Hudson remembered this part of Havana best from the old days. The part he loved now had then been just the road to Matanzas, an ugly stretch of town, the castle of Atares, a suburb whose name he did not know, and then a brick road with towns strung along it. You sped through them so that you did not remember one from another. Then he had known every bar and dive around this part of town, and San Isidro had been the great whorehouse street of the waterfront. It was dead now, with not a house functioning on it, and had been dead ever since they closed it and shipped all the whores back to Europe. That great shipment had been the reverse of how Villefranche used to be when the American ships on the Mediterranean station would leave and all the girls would be waving. When the French ship left Havana with the girls aboard, all the waterfront was crowded, and it was not only men that were saying goodbye, waving from the shore, the docks, and the seawall of the harbor. There were girls in the chartered launches and the bumboats that circled the ship and ran alongside her as she went out the channel. It was very sad, he remembered, although many people thought it was very funny. Why whores should be funny, he had never understood. The shipment was supposed to be very comic, though. But many people were sad after the ship had gone, and San Isidro Street had never recovered. The name still moved him, he thought, although it was a dull enough street now and you hardly ever saw a white man or a woman on it, except for truck drivers and delivery cart pushers. There were gay streets in Havana where only Negroes lived, and there were some very tough streets and tough quarters, such as Jesus y Maria, which was just a short distance away. But this part of town was just as sad as it had ever been since the horse had gone. Now the car had come out onto the waterfront itself, where the ferry that ran across to Regla docked, and where the coastwise sailing ships tied up. The harbor was brown and rough, but the sea that was running did not make whitecaps. The water was too brown. But it was fresh and clear brown-looking after the black foulness of the inner parts of the bay. Looking across it, he saw the calm of the bay that lay in the lee of the hills above Casablanca, where the fishing smacks were anchored, where the gray gunboats of the Cuban Navy lay, and where he knew his own ship was anchored, although he could not see her from here. Across the bay, he saw the ancient yellow church and the sprawl of the houses of Regla, pink, green, and yellow houses, and the storage tanks and the refinery chimneys of Belot, and behind them, the gray hills toward Cojimar.
"Do you see the ship?"
the chauffeur asked. "Not from here." Here they were to the windward of the smoking chimneys of the electric company, and the morning was as bright and clean, and the air as clear and new-washed as on the hills of the farm. Everyone moving about the docks looked cold in the norther. "Let's go to the Floridita first," Thomas Hudson said to the chauffeur.
"We're only 4 blocks from the embassy here."
"Yes, but I said I wished to go to the Floridita first."
"As you wish."
They rode straight up into town and were out of the wind, and passing the warehouses and stores, Thomas Hudson smelled the odor of stored flour and sacks and flour dust, the smell of newly opened packing cases, the smell of roasting coffee that was a stronger sensation than a drink in the morning, and the lovely smell of the tobacco that came strongest just before the car turned to the right toward the Floridita. This was one of the streets he loved, but he did not like to walk along it in daylight because the sidewalks were too narrow and there was too much traffic, and at night, when there was no traffic, they were not roasting the coffee and the windows of the storehouses were closed, so you could not smell the tobacco.
"It is closed," the chauffeur said.
The iron shutters were still down on both sides of the cafe. "I thought it would be. Go on down Obispo now to the embassy." This was the street he had walked down 1,000 times in the daytime and in the night. He did not like to ride down it because it was over so quickly, but he could not justify himself delaying and reporting any longer, and he drank the last of his drink and looked at the cars ahead, the people on the sidewalk, and the crossing traffic on the north and south streets, and saved the street for later when he could walk it. The car stopped in front of the embassy and consulate building, and he went in. Inside, you were supposed to fill out your name and address and the object of your visit at a table where a sad clerk with plucked eyebrows and a mustache across the extreme lower part of his upper lip looked up and pushed the paper toward him. He did not look at it and went into the elevator. The clerk shrugged his shoulders and smoothed his eyebrows. Perhaps he had emphasized them a little too much. Still, they were cleaner and neater that way than woolly and bushy, and they did go with his mustache. He had, he believed, the narrowest mustache it was possible to achieve and still have a mustache. Not even Errol Flynn had a narrower one. Not even Pincho Gutierrez. Not even Jorge Negrete. Still, that son of a bitch Hudson had no right to walk in like that and ignore him.
"What sort of maricones have you on the door now?" Thomas Hudson asked the elevator operator. "That's not a maricón. That's nothing."
"How's everything here?"
"Good, fine. The same as always."
He got off at the 4th floor and walked down the hall. He went in the middle door of the 3 and asked the Marine warrant officer at the desk if the colonel was in.
"He flew down to Guantanamo this morning."
"When will he be back?"
"He said he might go to Haiti."
"Is there anything for me?"
"Nothing with me."
"Did he leave any message for me?"
"He said to tell you to stick around."
"How was he feeling?"
"Awful."
"How did he look?"
"Terrible."
"Was he plugged at me?"
"I don't think so. He just said to tell you to stick around."
"Is there anything I ought to know?"
"I don't know. Is there?"
"Cut it out."
"Okay. I suppose you had it pretty dusty, but you weren't working for him in this office. You get out to sea. I don't give a goddamn.
Take it easy.
Are you staying out on the country?
Yes, but I'm going to be in town today and tonight.
He won't be back today or tonight. I'll call you out in the country when he comes in.
You're sure he's not plugged at me?
I know he's not plugged at you. What's the matter? Have you got a bad conscience?
No. Is anybody else plugged at me?
As far as I know, not even the Admiral is plugged at you. Go on out and get drunk for me.
I'm going to get drunk for myself first.
Get drunk for me, too.
What's the matter? You're drunk every night, aren't you?
That's not enough. How did Henderson do?
All right. Why?
Nothing.
Why?
Nothing. I just asked you. You have any complaints?
We don't make complaints.
What a man. What a leader.
We formulate charges.
You can't. You're a civilian.
Go to hell.
I don't have to. I'm there now.
You call me as soon as he gets in and make my compliments to the colonel and tell the colonel I checked in.
Yes, sir.
What's the sir for?
Politeness.
Goodbye, Mr. Hollins.
Goodbye, Mr. Hudson. Listen, keep your people where you can find them in a hurry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hollins.